What's up, guys? Welcome to the Humans of MarTech podcast. His name is John Taylor. My name is Phil Gamache. Our mission is to future-proof the humans behind the tech so you can have a successful and happy career in marketing. What's up, everyone? Today, we have the pleasure of sitting down with Josh Kim, growth marketing lead at Notion. Josh started his career in strategic planning and analysis before moving to growth product management. He was the second growth PM hire at Inflection, an employment screening startup, where he worked on their conversion optimization team. He then moved over to marketing operations at Credit Karma and later became the first hire on their growth and engagement team, where he owned implementation and testing, focusing on monthly active users. Josh then spent 3 years at Spotify, where he held different growth marketing roles, owning different products from consumer to creator and finally marketplace. And most recently, he's moved over to Notion, first focusing on growth lifecycle and product marketing, and recently leading the growth marketing team. Josh also advises startups within the first round capital portfolio as an expert in residence. Josh, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, totally. What an intro. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here and talk all things MarTech.
This episode is brought to you by our friends at Knack. Launching an email or landing page in your marketing automation platform shouldn't feel like assembling an airplane mid-flight with no instructions, but too often, that's exactly how it feels. Knack is like an instruction set for campaign creation, from establishing brand guardrails and streamlining your approval process to Knack's no-code drag-and-drop editor to help you build emails and landing pages. No more having to stop midway through your campaign to fix something simple. Knack lets you work with your entire team in real time and stops you having to fix things mid-flight. Check them out at knack.com, that's K-N-A-K, and tell them we sent you.
Yeah, Josh, thanks so much for joining us. You know, I want to just jump right into the growth marketing stuff. As a bit of a growth marketer myself, I'm looking at your resume and think, wow, you've worked at some really cool companies like Spotify and now Notion, which is a product that both Phil and I know and love. I think for lots of us in the growth marketing and product marketing mindset, we see this as a bit of a dream, name brand companies that walk the walk of product-led growth. What lessons can you share us about working from these companies that people like myself can transfer to our day jobs?
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you. And, you know, I feel really fortunate to have had the chance to work at some really great brands, really cool companies, and also products that I really love and use in my day-to-day. I still listen to Spotify every day. Notion very much runs my life, as you can ask my wife. And so, yeah, I feel really grateful for those experiences. I'd say that if I look back on my career, particularly at the last three companies I've been at, each one has sort of imparted a very specific lesson about growth and brand and marketing and how those sort of culminate into how companies, businesses, and brands grow. So if I go all the way back to Credit Karma, you know, as mentioned, Credit Karma was where I first sort of dove into marketing chops and really got the chance to work with some of the best growth people I've worked with and met to date. This is where I would say I really, really honed and developed my growth chops, learned how to market a brand and a product, but also do it in a fun way and with some personality. At Spotify, I got the chance to get a masterclass on how brand and growth loops can work together and really meld together to drive business growth at scale. I think the perfect example of this is the you know, yearly holiday campaign that is near and dear to all of our hearts, Spotify Wrapped. I got to work on that from both the consumer and creator lens during my time there, which really helped me to understand how you not only think about, you know, building your super flashy brand campaign, but also how you build the system underneath it and the foundation underneath it that's baked in data and insights to drive growth at scale. And then at Notion, really excited to be here. I lead the growth marketing team right now, and it's just, I feel really fortunate to work with a world-class group of practitioners across marketing, growth product, engineering, data science, design, et cetera, all, you know, working on our mission of making tool making ubiquitous. And I think looking back, you know, the common thread I draw is working on products and brands that really strike a chord with their consumers. So from Credit Karma, you know, at the end of the day, Credit Karma is like a credit score financial product, but they were able to make their branding really, really resonate with their consumers and with their customer base. And, you know, it made it feel really approachable, friendly, and create a lot of brand affinity within their base, which was really interesting. Spotify's brand is revered globally, and it's because of the way that they respect the artists, the craft, and the listening experience. And that notion, it's just sort of insane how passionate people are about a productivity tool. And I think that's a testament to the team's ability to really craft and hone a voice that really resonates with a ton of people, a lot of communities, and just your average user.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's such a cool origin story and experience that you've shared with us. You know, you've been in the growth game for some time. I'm sure you remember back in the day when growth hacking was all the rage and, you know, marketers were trying to inject themselves into the growth, into growth loops and try to get, you know, more users into the system. And from those early days, I think that a lot of folks in growth really became attuned to data and using that in terms of their testing. However, as time's gone on, I feel like product growth and growth marketing has really matured to become the multidisciplinary, in fact, working very closely with product teams. So do you kind of agree with the evolution of that product growth angle? So becoming multidisciplinary, having people in multiple teams, having growth be a bit of a team sport. And then on top of that, as a follow-up, because I'm going to assume you're going to say yes to that, is what do you think makes for a great growth team?
Yeah. First of all, 100%. I can totally remember the days when, you know, growth hacking was the hottest term, all the books and blog posts and, you know, tips and tricks on Twitter that are coming out. I remember that well. And I would put myself in the camp of people who, you know, feel a little bit of cringe nowadays when I hear that term. I think it comes from a place of like, you know, I think a lot of growth people will now feel that you can't really hack growth. Like, yes, there's things you could do to like make, you know, metrics swing or like get juices or like, you know, make things spike quickly. But it comes from a place of having really solid foundations and thinking in first principles. And that's why, you know, when I hear the term, I'm like, yes, but there's like something deeper underneath that that we need to unpack. Definitely think though that the essence of that period of like being obsessed with growth hacking and startups and founders really trying to like, you know, crack that strategy to find and scale that next growth hack, like that's been captured in how growth is practiced today. I think it's captured really in the foundation being around data and how do you leverage data? How do you measure things? How do you extract insights in a way that's scalable? And lends itself to strong execution and this really like rinse and repeat cycle of experimenting, measuring, ideating, and moving quickly. And so now I would see that most growth teams that are successful are when they're very multidisciplinary. For example, a setup that I've always pushed for, and this goes back to my time at Credit Karma, is when we think about a pod, typically on engineering, you know, you'll have a PM, a group of engineers, usually an EM, data scientist, design, et cetera. And the whole idea of setting up pods in that structure is so that you're getting everyone who has a decision-making, like is part of that decision-making process to be in the same room, to be part of the same conversations. And what I found is that actually adding a growth marketer or a growth person to the mix can set that team up for even more success and to move even faster and to have even more impact. And so that was really popular at Credit Karma. I actually trialed it myself for the first time at Spotify, where I sort of like injected myself into a pod. And because it was so successful, it's something that I've brought with me today. And so now I instill that in a lot of the growth teams that I set up now. Where I say like, hey, we should build this around like a common theme, common area, but also make sure all relevant functions and parties are there and are represented. And I would say that's been extremely successful at Notion, where we now have, you know, a growth marketer represented in most product groups now. And then to your second question, I think what makes a really strong, effective growth team, I would boil it down to really three areas. And I would say the first is a shared North Star. Second is really clear roles and responsibilities. And the third is adhering to really strong fundamentals. So for the first area, a strong North Star, this is really usually takes the form of like a key metric or a primary metric that the entire org, the entire team can lean on as this is what we're trying to achieve. And the reason this is so important is because when teams are executing, it's extremely easy to get lost in the hundreds, if not thousands, of test options or variants or strategies that you could be building. And so having that very, very clear goal or North Star helps bring clarity and focus to the conversations where you can kind of ideate and, you know, converse about all these things. But at the end of the day, you have to prioritize and you have to be ruthless about it. And having that defined North Star is the best way to approach those conversations. Roles and responsibilities. I think when you're in a disciplinary function like growth, having really clear swim lanes across the team really helps to bring focus and allows everyone to be extremely effective by letting them lean on their strengths and what they do best, but also helping them to lean on their weaknesses where others might be able to fill those gaps. And then lastly, fundamentals, you know, all those classic growth terms and sort of principles, but moving quickly, done is better than perfect. And something I really like to stress with my teams is test hygiene, to make sure that when we're thinking about experiment design, we're going back to the fundamentals, ensuring that, you know, things are set up properly, that we're being thoughtful about what we're testing for and what we're measuring. And then, you know, making sure we're executing well after that.
Very cool, Josh. You mentioned clear roles and responsibilities. I'm curious your take on what is the ideal role and responsibility for the growth marketer on that pod, and how did you define that first when you implemented yourself in that pod at Spotify, and talk to us about that story.
Yeah, so I think it will always come down to an assessment of what the team current layout is and like where they spike or and where they need more support. Mm-hmm. That married with the same assessment of the growth marketer, like is it someone who spikes on paid ads or spikes on, you know, data and analytics or can assist with email or a lifecycle channel? And does that pair well with the team that that person is being paired with? And so that kind of comes first, right? You say like, okay, here are the teams, here are the people that could be embedded. How do we match make in a way that's going to lend itself to the best results? And so for me, I would say that at that point, I would spiking high on data analytics, on lifecycle, email, engagement channels, and experiment design. And so when I was working with that team, I made it a point to say like, okay, I'm going to work like hand in hand with this data engineer because I've done this in the past and I feel comfortable getting to the weeds of like how we build pipelines, how we make sure that we have really strong test hygiene and experiment design, how we're going to be, you know, ensuring that we build quickly, but also in a way that's comprehensive and actually, you know, future-proof. And that turned out to be the best setup. You know, I was working super closely with this person, working in sprints, but then I could also put my sort of like email hat on and assist from that lens of saying, okay, I can test this really quickly. And then like, I can like help you write the HTML, whatever it might be. So that while we do have clear swim lanes, we're also passing things off to each other in a way that makes it really efficient and in a way than sport versus an individual one.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense. There's a bit of art to the matchmaking and like figuring out where folks are spiking, because I feel like as a manager, you might have a perception of where a certain individual is spiking, but they themselves might like they're spiking in one area, but maybe they've spent too much time in that area in the past and they're actually hungrier for something else. So I feel like there really is an art to that. But I'm curious on the testing side, you can call back whatever experience it is, like CK, Spotify, or Notion, but like I'm sure there's a wealth of memorable experiments that, you've gotten a chance to be a part of. I'd love to hear maybe some of the successes, but also really curious about not the failures, but like maybe some of the surprising outcomes. Like you guys thought this was going to kill, but it actually bombed, or there was like a surprising outcome there. Curious.
Yeah, those are always the most fun ones, right? Is the ones that kind of, we integrated a startup that had built this music marketplace for musicians where sort of like a Fiverr or an Upwork, if you needed a track mastered or even produced, you could go out and find someone to do it for you. And so the really interesting thing about this marketplace was that the community around it was crazy. Like these people loved the product. They were ambassadors. They were huge advocates of the brand and really took it upon themselves to spread word of mouth and really drive adoption within their communities. So from a growth perspective, when a marketer hears things like that around brand advocacy and community and word of mouth, they're like, boom, referral program, right? Like that's, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, of course. And so naturally, working with the founders, we started designing and ideating on launching a referral program for the business. You know, you kind of go through these steps when you're doing this. You think about, okay, what's the offer? Is it two or one-sided? How do you make it lucrative, but also easy to understand? What are the mechanics? Where do you build it? Do you outsource it or do you build it yourself internally? All those steps, et cetera. We essentially went in with this hypothesis of, hey, the people in this marketplace are fanatics about the brand. We think that we can launch a referral program and it'll take off and really drive top of funnel growth and brand awareness for the company. So let's do it. So designed it, built it, shipped it, and lo and behold, it was kind of dead on arrival, honestly. we shipped it and had this pretty elaborate promo strategy, built it into the product so it felt cohesive, and then felt like we were going out with a pretty competitive offer. It ended up not taking off whatsoever. I think we got like a few referrals successfully, but when we, you know, did the classic like funnel breakdown of like, okay, where's the drop off? And it just turned out to be like everywhere. Like it was just not taking off within the community. And people weren't seeing it as an effective way to promote the brand and to, or that they didn't think the offer was lucrative enough. And so I think looking back on that, we did retros on it, et cetera. We actually ended up sunsetting the program. The key lessons that I extracted from it and that sort of like I take with me now when I'm thinking about referral programs is one is to make this an incentive as compelling as possible. I think when you hear about these sorts of programs in the past, you know, Uber, DoorDash, all these like gig economy marketplaces, but also Dropbox, the incentive and the offer is typically at the forefront of why it's successful. It's easy to understand and it's extremely compelling because it solves an immediate need. And for the time that we built this, it was somewhat compelling, but the time at which it was useful and valuable was something that we hadn't actually nailed. And so that's a lesson that I really take and kind of underline whenever we're talking about referral programs now. And the second broader lesson for me was this program was like one of 10 things we launched in a quarter. And I think looking back, we probably could have made it work or like identified why it wouldn't work or iterated on how to make it successful if we had brought some more focus to our work. And so just another lesson to think about, hey, if there are 10 things, how do we draw some really, really clear cut lines to make sure that we're focusing on the most important 3 things and intentionally saying we're not going to do the other 7 because they're not worth it or our time is better spent elsewhere. So that's a failure. That's you know, battle scar that I'll take with me and, you know, come out of with a ton of learnings. I think on the other side, something that was really successful and maybe like a little surprising, Early on during my time at Notion, I was running web optimization. We tested everything. And, you know, Notion back then was at a state where the marketing site, our homepage, hadn't been updated in like years or at least many months. Marketing team was small, like everyone did a little bit of everything. And so I was running a few experiments and had gotten some wins. And then one of the experiments that I ended up running, and it was only because I was doing some peer analysis and looking like, hey, people like in B2B SaaS companies, they use different language around how to get people to enter the sales funnel and go to the pipeline. And on the top nav, you say like contact sales, which feels very transactional. Feels like, okay, yeah, get to the point, go talk to the salesperson. Do I actually want to do that? You know, et cetera. Others were using language like request a demo or, you know, get in touch with our team or things, other variants like that. And so we tested it. We did like a multivariate test, use a third-party vendor. And actually ended up seeing that different language, and I think it's still up now, but request a demo ended up being extremely effective. And it led to like increased pipeline, which we kind of like backed in all the way down into like, hey, this actually drives like significantly meaningful revenue for us when it gets all the way down to closed deals. It all started from obviously one of the most important and valuable services, your website and your homepage. But from a very basic like CTA text test. And I think that really just, you know, made me remember that it's never too late or it's never not a good idea to test the simple things. And most of the time, they're going to work.
I think that's a really cool story around the requested demo. I have a follow-up question around how do you select tests? Like some of the advice that we've talked about with other guests is like, the first step in launching an A/B test is having an idea of what to test and if it's worth testing and selecting your tests. And I think you kind of hit on that point a little bit with the website optimization, but I'm wondering if you could go a little deeper on that for our listeners.
Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, I think there's like a very rigorous way to do this, right? You say, okay, if we break down all of our options into numbers and we say, just let's just say like website optimization, for example, I've gone through this exercise with my team. You look at the website, how much monthly traffic does each page get? If you break that into like impressions and like amount of clicks and like how that converts into signups, what are those relative rates? If you apply lifts against them, what's the size of the prize? And you eventually turn it into like a math equation where you can look at, okay, if we test on this page and see this expected lift, we can generate this many more incremental signups, which turn into this many dollars based on historical conversion rates, yada, yada, yada. And you basically turn it into like a big spreadsheet with different variables that point you to like, this should be done first, this should be in the second, third, fourth, fifth, and stack ranking. I think that's a great way to do it in the beginning because you can basically apply some methodology, numbers, logic to the madness. The challenge is when you don't have that data and you actually can't like turn it into a simple equation. And that's where I think you kind of, again, have to lean on a bit of the art around it and say like, well, intuitively, like where do we think makes the most sense? It's probably a combination of what hasn't been touched in a while. Where do we know a bunch of people go to? And what do we think is the most valuable piece of the pie? And so, you know, in a world where perfect data doesn't exist and earlier on at startups, you typically don't have access to the data, you kind of have to lean onto that intuition, which is built and developed over time as you work on the business and you start to get a feel for where the highest leverage points are.
Yeah, very cool. Even like in the RICE, like it is what I've used in past companies.
Yeah.
Like if you did the RISE prioritization model for the partner program referral idea, it was probably like a decent lift on it, but the potential impact of it, like there's so much art that goes into that, right? Like what is the potential impact of that? The scale was just so big that It probably still would have come out like at the top of the list on the Rice scoring, and it probably still would have ended up being part of the list of experiments. So yeah, it's interesting to hear how you prioritize that, and also how do you balance like spending time figuring out what you want to test versus actually just launching stuff and getting tests out the door. This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Census. Census is a data activation platform loved by marketing teams at Sonos, Canvas, Crocs, Notion, and more. As a customer, I've experienced the magic of Census firsthand. Their no-code audience hub and reverse ETL enable me to use our cloud data warehouse to power growth and create highly personalized customer journeys in all of my marketing platforms like Iterable and Google Ads. If you like the Humans of Martech podcast graphics and you want your very own image, we're doing a monthly raffle for a personalized t-shirt designed by us. Enter to win at getcensus.com/humans. Yeah, I'm curious your take on, I know you've said in one interview that I've read, Notion Crow has been a meaningful program for driving top of funnel growth, but under the hood, it's taken a bunch of time in tooling and process and roadmap to get there. So talk to us about that journey and maybe touch on the tech stack piece. Obviously, like being a MarTech podcast, we love to talk about stack there. And maybe like specifically, I've been pretty deep on lifecycle for most of my career. Curious about the lifecycle experiments earlier on and at Notion and, you know, like the stack. I looking at the code on Notion there, like there's a mix between Amplitude and Segment. Yeah. Thrown that into a data warehouse. I know you guys are using Segment, Census, and then you're throwing that into the ESP. Like, yeah, I would love to get you unpack that.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's actually a great example is to go dive in a bit deeper into lifecycle because I have a bunch of experience in that too and help build out the team and the processes there. And I think it's a perfect blend of how we've leveraged tooling and MarTech, but also people and process to actually turn that into a really successful engine for us. And so kind of going back to the beginning, but I was originally brought to Notion to lead lifecycle. And at that point, we kind of had our ESP in place and that was about it. Like as any lifecycle person will know, like data is probably the most important part about getting anything done with that channel and strategy. And what we really struggled with for like the first year was like, how do we enable the right data to get to the place that we can actually send messages to the people at the right time? Classic issue. And we eventually figured out like a patch solution for that like worked to get to us to the next phase. But once we had sort of built up the practice and started to get people to actually start sending messages, people on the team, what we realized was it had become extremely ad hoc. And so, you know, we go through the cycle of identifying a roadmap, you know, drawing up hypotheses, strategizing, ideating. And then from there, you have to go through the process of, okay, well, we have to design things, we have to write things, build them, QA, and then ship, test, measure, rinse and repeat. Each piece of that process has a failure point, whether it's, you know, oh, well, we're getting a ton of copy feedback. So like we need to like, you know, figure out how to navigate this. That's a failure point. Or, hey, the data scientist is backlogged and can't, you know, analyze this experiment that's been done for 2 weeks. And so we're backed up for like 4 weeks. That's a failure point. Or it's, I want to try out this new segment and I need to find a way to get data engineering to send it into our ESP for us so we can actually test it. Another failure point. And what we realized and remembered is that for growth teams, shipping velocity is like the most important ingredient to our success. Because in a quarter's time, if we can only get 10 shots or experiments up, and you can count on maybe one or two of those being wins, then making actual impact is heavily dependent on shipping quickly and consistently. And so what we did was essentially sort of break down our processes into key points. And started having conversations and ideating around, well, how can we either use tools to automate or leverage people to build processes or mini tools for us, or outsource things so that they are just completely running independently. And so, for example, for targeting, we ended up using a combination of Segment and Census in a self-serve way that allows the team to actually push their own attributes, profiles, whatever they need into our ESP. So they don't have to, you know, go through the sprint process and like release process with data engineering and data platform teams to actually enable targeting. For experiments, our data scientists, partly from getting tired of getting constant pings from us, but he helped us build this really smart integration to Statsig that enabled the team to essentially self-serve their own experiment setups, but more importantly, their own results. And so they can now own the process from ideation, design, build, ship, and then analyze all on their own by leveraging Statsig and our ESP. And then for the more tactical things around like template creation, coding, copy, creative, we ended up outsourcing a bunch of things and we built like templates for creative so that we didn't have to spend a bunch of time and cycles working with the creative and brand team. And instead, they gave us something that was like, hey, this is like stamped, certified, we're good to go as long as you stay within these restraints. And then the team go crazy testing whatever they wanted. And that's a super important element to really juice performance. All in all, essentially by like leveraging MarTech, leveraging tooling, leveraging process, people, automation, we were able to remove a ton of dependencies that we had on other teams and individuals. And the end result was amazing. So I think year one, when we hadn't had all this in place, we were shipping like maybe a couple experiments a quarter. Over the last year, we've shipped over 75 experiments, I think close to 100. And our hit rate was somewhere between like 10 to 20%. And so the team has really turned it into an engine of like, hey, we have an idea. We've now built a path to get that idea into an experiment in like a couple days. Which means we're paired with Notion's top of funnel and we can get experiment results really quickly. And they've now become like the de facto team that people go to with like a question or a hypothesis, or, you know, they want help understanding our users or something. And we can turn that around relatively quickly. So that I think is like a great example of, you know, how we leverage these different tools, but also people and process to really get the best possible outcome. And of course, none of this would have been achievable without a lot of partnership with our data team and our engineering teams, because they really helped us ideate, design, and build all of this so that we can get to this state really quickly.
Yeah, that's so cool to kind of get a glimpse into the growth operations that you're running. And, you know, it kind of dovetails nicely into the next question that I have, really around MarTech's role in a top tier growth team. And I have a hypothesis, Josh, that I could take you out of your team and put you into a low tech team, and you'd probably still be able to build up a fair amount of velocity. The analogy that comes to my mind is a tool doesn't make the carpenter, but it can make the carpenter a whole heck of a lot faster. The nail gun versus the hammer, we can build things faster than ever before, ship things at a velocity. You know, and I was curious just to talk to you a little bit about what should teams be looking to augment? Like, what processes internally can you augment with the latest and greatest MarTech?
Yeah. Thank you for the words. Those are very kind. I would hope so. that's my hope as a growth leader. I think the beauty of where we're at currently, like with, you know, a lot, ton of tools being built for knowledge workers within the AI space, still in like this low code, no code movement, is that new tools are popping up every day. I'm sure both of you get like tens of emails a day or a week with like, hey, I'm building this thing, I love your thoughts, or, you know, whether it's MarTech or whatever it might be. And that runs the danger of, you know, potentially feeling tool overload and there being a lot of noise in the market. But typically the guidance that I give to my team is that if you find yourself doing a task like more than once a week, there's probably a way to automate it. And there's probably either a tool or a process or some sort of automation to minimize what I like to refer to as like task overload, so that you can actually remove that from your mental overhead and make more space for deep thinking and strategic thinking. And this is an option, an opportunity to make a plug for Notion as a great tool for that around automations and databases to do a lot of this heavy lifting. And so I think that when I talk to my team about this and we talk about like, well, I'm so busy and like, you know, I have all these things I need to do. I think once you like sort of break that down into, well, what can you do with the time that you have if you kind of study what your current daily, weekly, monthly tasks are and how you might be able to automate them so that they're lower bandwidth for you, can quickly turn into like, great, let me actually do more with my time and turn more towards these tools that can make me more efficient. And I found that it can be kind of scary, like how efficient people can make their work. Once you identify the one to like three tools that work really well for you, and learn how to use them to your advantage.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, and I'm sure a few of our listeners are thinking, maybe unfairly, like, hey, well, you're working at cool companies like Notion and Spotify, like you have endless MarTech budget and all of this. And I'm curious, like, you know, if I were to pluck you out, as we were saying in the last question, and put you into a startup, what advice would you have for that, like, low budget, low tech, one person growth team on at a startup? Like, what transferable skills do you think that you would bring? And what lessons do you think you could have for folks?
Yeah, that's funny. I think you'd be surprised, honestly. In my experience, just because a company has a big brand or, you know, a large presence doesn't mean that they've got to figure it out from like a tech perspective. If you really start to look under the hood, and in some cases it's been actually quite the opposite. But I think that when I look back as to like how, MarTech has evolved or like progressed within an organization, in my experience, it's usually gone one of two ways. The first, and Spotify is a good example of this, is when MarTech investment is approached from like a tops down perspective. You know, a leader or the company says, hey, we're going to make a big investment, because we have conviction or proof that this will work. Spotify Wrapped is a good example. They say, we're going to make this happen. Don't care how much it costs, but we believe it's the right thing to do. And we're going to make it beautiful and make it work. That ends up in having conversations to say like, well, that means we need a huge team of engineers, data people, data scientists, marketers, to pivot towards working mostly on just this big brand campaign and making it happen. And that then turns into, well, we need to make these investments. We need to build piping. We need to enable all the data. We need these new tools to enable all this, et cetera, which results in a big investment, but it comes from the top. And that means it's going to happen and you're going to see if it works. And in Spotify's case with Wrapped, did work. And that's why it keeps happening. And that's why, during that season, really the back half of the year in preparation for Wrapped, large percentage of the company is working on it. That's what makes it so successful. On the flip side, at Notion, I've seen more of like a bottoms up approach where we take this more like, how do we like sort of prove out these bets that we have and start to identify and illustrate the need to make more investments? And so, for example, like the lifecycle team that I called out, they basically made a lot of things happen and drove a ton of impact with little to nothing. They had to sort of like duct tape a bunch of systems and automations and processes together to actually build up velocity and make impact.
Yeah, and now, usually the case with lifecycle.
Yep. It's painful, but you know, it takes time. And now they're in a state where they can say like, hey, we made all this happen. If we can invest in this way, we think we can 3x impact or things like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's typically how I've seen the shape of this and in terms of like driving the conversation around MarTech and investment to take place.
Very cool. I love the breakdown there. I think there's so many threads that I want to pull down on from your tech stack answer all the way to your answer here on comparing, you know, stuff coming from the top or bubbling down. But I was curious to get your take on this idea of Notion's growth through community and product. And maybe you can get threads on Spotify also, because there are definitely some similarities on the growth model there. But from the outside looking in, at least, it seems like Notion's growth has been fairly linear and straightforward. But we know that like growth is never easy. And it seems like community and product at least are two of the big components of the growth strategy. Talk to us about these two factors and how they've played a role at Notion or Spotify also.
Yeah, totally. So the community angle for Notion is really, really interesting. And it's one of the reasons I actually came to Notion is because when I was first talking to the team, I was like, I don't even know what this company does. Like, I don't know what the product is. And then upon, you know, doing some Google searches, looking it up on Reddit, I was like, wow, like this thing has legs. Like, you know, people are really fanatic about it.
Hardcore fans.
Hardcore fans, like really, really, really like tons of super fans. You know, people out there who are getting like Notion tattoos or like, you know, are making a living off of building Notion templates. And it all comes down to like being obsessed with productivity and wanting to tell the world about it. And I think that's really the essence of what our community strategy and team have been trying to capture. Is, you know, this was like community was run by a very small team and it happened super organically and grassroots in the beginning. It was primarily about engaging with our super fans, getting feedback about our product and sort of just like running with ideas and, you know, figuring out ways like we can continue to sort of stimulate and engage with the community. Fast forward a few years, we've seen really, really rapid growth across each of our sort of community audiences. We have ambassadors, we have champions, we have consultants, and then most recently, like student leaders, where, you know, they're activating communities on campus. And each of them really serves a different purpose and attracts a different type of Notion user as well. And the way we engage with them is differently too. But I think across the board, if we look at how communities leverage today, they really drive a lot of the lifeblood of Notion to the product. They're involved in everything from like product launches and beta testing to, you know, how we get feedback about the product and how that comes to life within our development process. They help advocate for us. They build mini communities on their own. And we're really like, we want to enable them and empower them to do their best work out there. And so we have communities globally, we are really just trying to help them continue to be passionate about the product and the brand and really bring that magic to others in a way that feels like they're driving it. And that's how we would define success.
Yeah, it's fun. You know you have a good product when you see these fanatics and the community just kind of grows organically in a sense there. Another community I wanted to ask you about, you and I have this in common. In 2018, you took the retention and engagement cohort course at Reforge while you were at Credit Karma. I took it a year and a half after that, but talk to us about the role the course had in accelerating your career, maybe how you're able to speak about growth in different systems and processes that, you know, maybe you understood some of it before, but it kind of crystallized some of the systems. Just curious your take there.
Yeah, for sure. I think the biggest value add about taking that course at that time of my career was coming out of it, it armed me with the knowledge and sort of like the terminology and the baseline info to be able to think and speak about growth in a systematic way. I think kind of probably sounds similar to your experience, but previously I had the puzzle pieces in place to really be thinking about like, yeah, like how do you think about top of funnel and how do you think about like engagement and like using different channels to drive different metrics. But going through the process of really studying the art of growth and how it can be broken down into metrics and phases and user types and segments and like how that all works together in a model was super valuable. And mm-hmm. so I would personally recommend taking Reforged classes to all growth practitioners to get a super, super solid foundation how to think about growth, because it covers all the basics, all the way from like unit economics to life cycle stages to activation and onboarding. But they have even deeper classes now too, and specialized courses around product, marketing, brand strategy, and advanced growth strategy as well.
Yeah, they even rolled out a MarTech one I think, at some point last year too. Yeah, so I was pumped to see that.
Cool. Very cool.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Josh. Like, it's for me myself, it's been selfishly a very fun interview to have. I feel like a masterclass myself. But one question we ask all of our guests at the end of the show is around happiness and success. You're a growth marketing lead, expert in residence, cat dad, camping fanatic. One question we ask everybody is, how do you remain happy and successful in your career? How do you find balance between all the things you're working on while staying happy?
Yeah, for sure. Love this question. I'm always reminded of like a piece of advice that I heard really on in my career, is that, you know, your career is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I think especially in the earlier years, it's very easy to feel like I need to do as much as humanly possible to get ahead and to feel like I'm achieving success. And then what I found is that there's a stage in which you're like, I've worked my ass off. I am doing as much as I can. And wow, it is a long road ahead. And so I think really treating it in that way has helped me at least mentally frame it as like, yeah, it's going to be a marathon, and you got to really just enjoy the journey as it goes. And that brings me a lot of internal peace. And then I think also just seeking out the things within my role or scope that bring me the most energy and fulfillment. And so, for example, a couple of things right now for me are growth and development of my team. I'm in really taking a driver's seat in that, pairing with them on that. And two, cracking really tough growth problems around strategy. Like, how do we make this work? Like, what are the really key questions we need to ask, and how do we apply first principles to it? Those are really the areas that I'm really doubling down on and finding the most enjoyment from.
Awesome answer. This is such a fun interview. Really appreciate your time. Obviously, we'll link out to Notion, and John and I were just kidding, like we need to do just a deep dive episode on how we use Notion. John's like a consultant. I use it day in and day out for the podcast, but also for my startup. So huge fans of the brand, and really appreciate your time coming on the show, man. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me. This is fun. See you guys.
This episode was brought to you by Iterable. Where will you be on April 30th, 2024? AI and creativity are colliding, and Iterable's signature Activate Summit is the place to be. The automation game is changing, and you've got an opportunity to be a key player. Are you ready? Not just should you attend the conference, but you actually have an opportunity to win a full VIP experience. Iterable is giving away a grand prize package that'll whisk you away to San Jose for the summit and take care of everything in style. We're talking a full pass to Activate Summit. That's $1,000 worth of learning, networking, and inspiration with hundreds of marketing's brightest minds. A swanky VIP dinner to mingle with fellow attendees and speakers. A luxurious three-night stay at Signia by Hilton San Jose. Picture plush comfort and stunning views just steps away from all the action. And also a round-trip airfare within the U.S. to leave all the logistics to Iterable. Just focus on packing for your excitement. Entering is super easy. Just head over to iterable.com/activate before April 2nd and register for either in-person or the virtual experience, which is free. And that's it. You're officially in the running. So don't miss out on this chance to win a trip that'll boost your career and ignite your marketing mojo. Head over to iterable.com/activate and enter today. If you're still listening, first of all, thank you for being here. And as a reward for your attention, I'll leave you with my favorite newsletter. Check out the Marketing Operations Leader newsletter written by friend of the show, Daryl Alfonso. You might know him. We interviewed him in episode 101 of the podcast. Daryl's led marketing ops at big names like Indeed and AWS. And his newsletter is packed with practical advice and frameworks and new ideas to help you manage your marketing function. He launched it at the end of last year and he's already collected over 1,000 subscribers. So go to substack.com and search for Marketing Operations Leader and you'll thank us later. Our second favorite newsletter is the Humans of MarTech newsletter, of course. We'll be experimenting more with this in the future, but for now, think of this as the best way to get notified when a new episode drops. And you'll get a breakdown of the summary of the episode and all the key takeaways. So you know if this is an episode you want to listen, check out, maybe you want to watch it on YouTube or just read the GPT-powered summary blog post. It's the best way to support the show and help us attract more sponsors. So if you like the show, you like our content, you can support us by signing up at humansofmartech.com. Again, really appreciate you and we'll catch you next week.